So it's almost like we're this old married couple.
I don't care.
Basically, the outside world just sees us bickering all the time. But we actually do think alike a whole lot. Okay, anyway. So I'm going to be talking about sort of the work our group has been doing most recently on time-dependent phenomena, trying to model the time-dependent changes in the disk and connect that up with observations, again, as more of a test of the viscous decretion disk model. Of course, I could not have done this without all of my marvelous collaborators, particularly Alex Garciotti at Sao Paulo. Xavier Habois did a lot of the computer runs, numerical work, and the time-dependent stuff. John Wisniewski was a student of Karen, did a lot of the observational work along with his student, Zach Draper. And of course, the list keeps going on and on. Okay. So where were we when I started this? I had just started working on the wind compressed disk and I'd come up with this idea that this disk was going to be a very, very thin disk. I was talking to Doug Geis one day and he had an artist friend, I'm sure many of you have seen this picture, and they wanted to have an idea of what the disk looked like, and we were talking, chatting about it, saying, well, it's a thin disk, it's emitting hydrogen. So ultimately came up with this picture here where we've got a thin hydrogen disk, the star sticking out that you can see. Actually, it's not bad. Fast forward 20 years, I've dreamed for many, many years of being able to actually, from first principles, calculate what you would observe. And we're now able to do that. And this is a synthetic image from our HGDS code that shows zeta tau, real model of zeta tau. Zeta tau is almost an edge on disk. So we are looking at the star. If you look carefully, you'll see it's oblate here because it's a rapidly rotating star. Furthermore, the poles here are a little bit brighter than the equator because of the gravity darkening that's actually in the model. And furthermore, there's what looks to be something wrapping around the star. And that's because zeta tau requires a spiral density wave in its disk. And this is actually verified in the interferometry, that you can actually measure the asymmetries in the disk in the interferometry. And the model agrees beautifully, as I'll show you shortly here. Okay.
Which waveband?
What?
What waveband are
we looking at? I'm a theorist. What do I care? It's the continuum.
That's right next to bracket gamma.
Next to bracket gamma. But it's the continuum in comparison to use for comparison with the interferometry. Okay, one other thing I'll point out here real quick. Notice that the surface brightness here in the disk is lower than that in the star. And that's because the disk electron temperature and also the excitation temperature in hydrogen is lower than that in the photosphere. And so the disk actually, the part of it that's in front of the star does absorb some of the starlight. Okay, BE stars. Mostly I show this so I can talk a little bit about some of the radiative transfer effects that we need to understand a little bit for some of the later parts of the talk. Okay, typically you see double peaked hydrogen emission lines. The hydrogen lines in the infrared, principally the bracket lines, can be used in interferometers to actually begin to spatially resolve the disk. And that's what's led to an enormous amount of progress. Okay, there is also an infrared excess here. Okay, well, fundamentally what causes the infrared excess is the disk is optically thick. So there's an effective pseudophotospheric radius in the disk. So if you imagine looking at the star edge on, the total light you see is the star plus the light from the disk. Well, free-free opacity grows with wavelength. So as you go off into the infrared, the size of the disk just gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and that's what produces the infrared excess. Well, also, if you go shortward of the Balmer jump, the hydrogen bound free opacity increases, jumps on the ultraviolet side of the Balmer jump, and so again, the disk photosphere gets bigger, and so that means the disk partially fills in the Balmer jump. Well, that's if you're looking pole on. Things get more complicated, unfortunately, when you're looking edge on. So when you're looking edge on, you have a competition between what's here in front of the star. If we increase the opacity a little bit, the effective photospheric radius here is going to increase a little bit. Seen in projection, that's going to begin to cover up the bright spot here down on the bottom side of the star. And so the photospheric flux is going to be attenuated as a result of that. And the flux will actually drop as the opacity increases. Unless, of course, at the same time, the photospheric radius out here and the disk out to the side, that's increasing and increasing the surface area out here. And so it's a competition between the two effects. And it means you cannot easily anticipate, unfortunately, when you're looking at the edge-on case, whether the star is going to get brighter or fainter at a given wavelength when you increase the density of the disk. Oh well, that's real radiation transfer. It gets complicated sometimes. Okay, BE stars scatter light in their disk, produces polarization by scattering off the free electrons. Electron polarization, electron scattering polarization is wavelength independent, so this curve should be flat, but it's not. And that's because the material in the disk absorbs some of the starlight before it ever gets to the electrons to scatter. So what gets imprinted on top of the polarization spectrum is the absorption spectrum of the disk itself. So that means polarization is a great way to investigate the opacity sources in the disk itself. Notice in particular, we see a Balmer jump in the polarization. That's caused by the bound free opacity in the disk changing discontinuously here. There's a nice slope here in the Poisson continuum, so on and so forth. And so you see the hydrogen bound free opacity imprinted on top of the polarized spectrum there. Okay, so double peak emission lines. I know a lot of people in the audience are new to this field, so it's actually useful to quickly go through, just briefly, how do we get these double peak line profiles that you see. Okay, so we start here in the continuum. We see star plus disk here. The small red circle there, that's the effective photospheric radius of the disk in the continuum. Now, as we go to the blue side of the line, we see a little ear appear here. Well, in a Keplerian disk, the highest velocities coming towards you are on the left-hand side of the star, right next to the stellar photosphere. So that's where the line first begins to appear, is right next to the star here, and that produces this portion of the excess emission here, basically the intensity times that area. Now, as we go marching from blue towards red, go farther into the blue wing, now the emitting surface area here sort of breaks open instead of an ear. You begin to see two bars here, and this is actually where you get the maximum emitting area, and this produces the peak. Now, as we come wrapping on around, eventually the line center here, we have, of course, the emission of zero Doppler shift is straight in front of and behind the star, but the star is inclined. So the isophotes are foreshortened. Just like the continuum is elliptical here, the isophotes in H alpha are also elliptical and foreshortened. And so the emitting area actually is less at line center than out here in the line wings, and that causes the central reversal in the line. And it's not what a lot of people probably heard when they were growing up, that this is caused by the material in front of the disk simply absorbing the starlight. It's actually an area effect. Okay, now, come along interferometry. Optical interferometers now can measure the position of the photocenter as a function of wavelength. Essentially, as you go through a spectral line and an optical interferometer in the infrared, of course, the differential phase of the interference fringes shifts as you go through the line. And that differential phase changing means that the bright spot on the sky is changing direction just a little bit. So the differential phase in the interferometer is measuring the angular displacement on the sky of the shift of the photosphere. Okay, so what do we expect to see? Well, as we go in the blue, it shifts off to the left, comes back to the center, off to the right, and back in again. So you should get this characteristic sort of, people tend to call it an S-shaped curve. I guess it depends whether you lie on your side or which direction you turn that. But here's the shift of the photosphere across that line. Well, if you know how far away the star is, you can map that into physical distance. You model this in great detail, and you can actually essentially measure the rotation velocity of the disk versus radius. And you can prove that it is Keplerian rotation. So this was been done by many, many people now. Meyland, the French group, has done a lot of early work on that. You can also do this with spectroastrometry as well. And so we had a project to do that as well. And then the Chara people, John Monnier and crew, have also done this. So we've learned that the disks are Keplerian, which means that the gas is in orbit around the star. Well, the mass of the disk is not that big. It's only 10 to the minus 9 solar masses. If you have a pre-main sequence disk sitting there, that's very massive. It takes a long time to blow that away. But if you have a 10 to the minus 9 solar mass disk, it takes very little time for that material to either flow away on its own by viscosity or the stellar wind to entrain it or to photoevaporate the disk. Probably at most a few years, tens of years at most. And that means that you have to continually recreate the disk, which means you need a constant supply of mass. And this is one of the big problems for binary star models for creating the disk from as the source of mass. A binary might affect the BE star itself in some way and help make a BE star. But the mass can't come just from the secondary star. It has to come from the primary. Because that's the only mass reservoir you've got, really. Okay, second problem, Keplerian disks. Angular momentum is conserved. In orbit, the specific angular momentum increases with radius. So the only way to get the material to move outward in the disk is to supply angular momentum to it. Okay. Pre-main sequence people solved this problem a long time ago, actually solved by black hole people. The Shakura-Sunyaev alpha disk model, viscosity can actually act to take that orbital velocity with the velocity shear that's present in Keplerian rotation. That velocity shear exerts a torque, can add angular momentum, and transport angular momentum outward in the disk. And that's what allows the gas to slowly work its way out to larger and larger radii. So what we've discovered is you need essentially, we can separate the problem into two pieces. We have to supply the mass somewhere in the disk, put it in orbit, so we have to supply mass at Keplerian speeds, and then we have to transport the angular momentum. Okay, so as I said, viscosity is a well-known mechanism for doing this, as long as you can make the viscosity big enough, some kind of turbulent mixing. Viscosity itself, what that really is a mixing mechanism. If I can take two parcels of gas that are sort of moving at different speeds along this way and I mix them back and forth, they share their transverse momentum, and you can transfer shear velocity, shear momentum, from one parcel of gas to another by mixing it. So fundamentally, turbulent viscosity is some kind of mixing mechanism that mixes gas from different radii. Okay, but how is the disk fed? Okay, Stan talked a lot about this, so I'll try to sort of summarize, maybe go into a little more detail that he couldn't talk about, at least in a couple spots. So as he mentioned, we started off working on this with this wind-compressed disk idea, where we took the stellar wind itself, and as a result of rotation, discovered that it could fall down into the disk. Well, although the model didn't work, it was very, very helpful because it gave us the clues that we needed to understand what we do need to do to make a successful model. Fundamentally, I mean, Stan skipped over the reason why the model doesn't work at all to begin with, which is non-radial forces actually change the direction of the flow. It's a second order effect, but it turns out the second order effect dominates because two first order effects cancel. And so the second order one wins. But anyway, the fundamental problem was is when you started calculating the infrared excess, John Porter did this, you discovered that the actual density in the disk is too small to produce what's observed. And Stan pointed out the reason for this is that the disk leaks. In the inner part, material falls back onto the star. Well, why is that? Well, a stellar wind, as it comes off the star, has a radial force pushing on it, so its angular momentum doesn't change. And so if its angular momentum doesn't change, when I drop it into the disk, it's sub-Keplerian, it can't stay there, and so it just falls right back in. Okay, material that came in farther away still was subject to the radiative acceleration. The scale for that's the escape speed, and so the material got flushed out at several hundred kilometers a second. So that's the other lesson. Once you dump the material into the disk, you got to turn off the forces pushing it away so that it can just sit there in orbit. Okay, so Joe Casanelli and John Brown said, oh, we love magnetic fields. They like to work on magnetic winds. And magnetic fields can exert torques. See, here's the problem. We have to add angular momentum to the outflow from the star, right? Not many things do that. Magnetic fields do. So if you take something like a magnetospheric model, the strong magnetic field enforces solid body rotation. The slight kink, twist in the field lines can exert a torque and spin the gas up. So there's one point in the disk here where the co-rotation velocity equals the Keplerian orbital speed. So you dump gas down there and it's perfectly happy to go into orbit. But if you dump it inside that, it's sub-Keplerian. So guess what happens? As Stan showed in the movies, it piles up and then falls back onto the star sooner or later. If you dump it out farther, it's slightly above Keplerian, and even worse, you still got this damn magnetic field pushing on it that just flings it on out. Same problem. You forgot that you have to turn off the forces acting on the gas to let it build up. Okay, so that's another example of the issue that we face here. I don't think you talked about Kroll in your talk too much. Well, I'm going to cover it, damn it. Okay, a really nice idea, qualitative idea, was done by Peter Kroll, I believe it was a student of Hanushik's. He said, suppose you have some kind of non-radial mass ejection, like a point explosion on the surface of the star. Okay, well, some of that material goes forward, some of it goes backwards. The stuff that goes backwards is having angular momentum in some sense removed from it, so it's just ballistically going to fall right back onto the star. The stuff that goes forward can head on out and potentially go into orbit around the star. Except if you teach physics 101, you'll realize there's a slight issue here. Where does this orbit close? Right back here. Comes right back down to the stellar surface and runs into the star again. So if you really want to put it into orbit, you can't just eject it in the forward direction. You have to mix it with something else to circularize the orbit. Okay, but this is effectively a gravity filter that kind of sorts the material of high specific angular momentum from low specific angular momentum. And so the name of the game in trying to get to transfer angular momentum, because angular momentum is conserved, there's a price to be paid. You have to rob the rich and give to the poor. You have to rob the angular momentum from some place and give it to some material. So you have to have a way of dividing the angular momentum, separating it, ultimately drawing it from the star and then transferring it to a portion of the gas that can then go outward in the disk. Okay, so a summary of mass supply mechanisms. Magnetic spin up of material, but the problem is it's really hard to decouple the magnetic forces from the disk. Non-radial pulsations we heard about a little bit today, in nice talk, that in some sense this is kind of like Kroll's mechanism, where if we take the rotating star with some pulsations on it, we can maybe find some way to sort the angular momentum and supply it to some portion of the pulsating material and rob some other portion of it. Okay, but notice the velocities that they were using. They had the star rotating at 95% of critical. And the problem is that most of these things that have tried to use pulsations, you really can only add a small amount of the necessary energy and angular momentum, at least to date. This is still the great hope that somehow or another we can get this to work. Okay. And of course, for some reason, we always step away from the best idea that was ever invented in 1931 by Struve, which is to simply say, look, the star, for some reason, maybe we don't know why, is rotating at orbital speed. If it's rotating at orbital speed, it's no problem to put the equator into orbit. As Dan said, jump. You're in orbit. You're already there. Okay, so if you're already in orbit, then if you harness the viscosity, like what is done around black hole accretion disk, pre-main sequence accretion disk, using this alpha disk model for the source of viscosity, the star will naturally just spin out a disk. And that's what Lee did in 91, is he just basically took a pre-main sequence type model and ran it backwards. I mean, that's all it is. It's an accretion disk, run it backwards. Okay, but we still have to have the star spun up to critical rotation. And a really beautiful piece of work, Maeder and Meinet, supplied an important idea, which is that as the star evolves, the core wants to contract and spin up, and we can transfer the angular momentum out of the core of the star up to the surface layers. And if you can do that efficiently enough and not lose too much angular momentum through the stellar wind, by the end of the main sequence lifetime, you can get the star rotating at critical, probably if you adjust the model parameters just right. But, and there's always a but in this game, the observed rotation speeds are something like 80%. Now, maybe that's because we systematically underestimate the rotation rates because the line width saturates because of gravity darkening. So that's my great hope, is we're just simply underestimating all of this. But it probably the lesson here is that line widths stink as a method for determining the equatorial rotation velocity of the star, because no light wants to come out of the equator. So it's a really tough way to measure the rotation rates. So maybe there's another way to do it. There's another effect rotation has. It makes the star oblate. Okay, so we focus on the one example, one of the really closest BE stars that we could actually resolve the stellar disk, measure its shape. First time this was done, poor Armando Domiziano Gisalza measured an equatorial radius of 1.56, which is actually bigger than allowed at critical rotation. Now, that was probably because there was still a small residual disk present there. And remember, interferometry doesn't give you this picture. This is a lot of interpretation of data to use the visibility data as a function of position angle to estimate the size of the star. Okay, so it's hard, but okay. He's now gone on, used improved models, additional data, and also there was a small residual disk present that since disappeared that was contaminating some of the light. And the rotation velocity that he now comes up with is V on V orbital, that's what this W parameter is 0.94. Huh, I think you wanted to use 0.95 this morning in your pulsation model, so maybe that's not crazy. Okay, but the point here is that maybe a different way of trying to measure rotation rates is to look at how squashed the stars are. Interestingly, in Gerard van Bell's review article in 2012, there are a handful of stars that he's measured the oblateness. And that handful of stars, every single one of them is more oblate than predicted by the V sin I value. Okay, take it for what it's worth. One example certainly looks like it's rotating at critical. One example does not make a class, but nonetheless. Okay, so viscous decretion disks. Time for me to talk faster. So the idea is that in viscosity, you have anomalous viscosity, you have some kind of turbulent mixing that mixes material of different radii that produces an effective viscosity. Okay, the viscosity scales as the circulation speed times the size of the cell. What sets the size of the cell, sort of the maximum size of the cell, is how thick the disk is. So the viscosity is parameterized with a cell size, maximum cell size of the thickness of the disk, the scale height actually, times the sound speed. And because you don't know how fast it's actually moving, you throw a parameter alpha in front of it. And hence the rise of alpha disk theory. And the whole game in pre-made sequence, in part for a while, was trying to figure out what alpha is, this effective circulation speed. Now, before we go into that, how does the viscosity actually work? Allow the material to go from a small radius to a larger radius. So imagine here are three rings of material orbiting the star. The one that's closer to the star is going faster, so that pulls ahead, rubs against the middle ring, and tries to add angular momentum to the middle ring. The one outside is going slower, falls behind, pulls backwards. Now it's a contest, right? Which torque is bigger, the one from the inner ring or the outer ring? Well, what sets the value of the torque? It's a combination of the velocity gradient and the density. Velocity is set by Keplerian speed, so we don't have any choice in that, but what we do have a choice about is the density gradient. So, if the density is small enough on the inside compared to the outside one wins. If the outside one wins, we're robbing angular momentum. If we take angular momentum away from the green ring, it'll fall inward. If the density gradient's the other way around, it'll move outward. So I'll summarize that in just a second. So if we have, let me skip this, but you don't need to explain this. So there's a characteristic time for this to happen, called the diffusion time scale. When you work it out for a B-type star, scaling it to, at the time I did this, the popular value of alpha was 0.01. It came out to be about 20 years, which is kind of uncomfortably long for the time scale that we see in BE stars, which are more like a year. So I certainly at this point would have said I would rather alpha be something more like 0.1. And alluded to, we actually are seeing that alpha is close to 1 itself. And if alpha is close to 1, what does that mean? It means that the effective circulation velocity is this almost the sound speed. Okay, that's moving very fast. It's basically as fast as gas wants to move to mix, because if you move it faster than that, it's going to shock. You're going to dissipate energy. And so what this suggests is that the actual origin of this mixing mechanism is some kind of instability, perhaps the MRI instability, that runs away until there's an energy loss mechanism, say via shocks and radiative dissipation, that caps the growth of the instability. And that's why alpha tends automatically to be maybe something close to 1. Or I might just be full of it. Okay, steady state viscous disks. If we have a shallow density gradient, then the gas loses angular momentum, moves inward, and we get accretion. Steep density gradient, the opposite happens. The gas gains angular momentum and it flows outward. So what's the difference between an accretion disk and a decretion disk and an accretion disk? The density gradient. Just all depends how steep it is. Okay, now here's another little thing that people want to tend to overlook. To have a decretion disk, that angular momentum is transported outward through the disk by viscosity. It has to come from somewhere. And that means two things. You need an angular momentum source, and you need to couple it. It means there has to be a torque. So there has to be a torque supplied at the base of the disk. Whatever that mechanism is has to do that somehow. If I pull angular momentum out of the star, it wants to spin down. Okay, so you can now do calculations A lot of people have done this now, starting with Okazaki in 2001, including the pressure terms and other things in the fluid equations, get the structure of the disk. Basically, in steady or close to steady state, the density falls as r to the minus 3.5. The outward flow velocity, radial velocity, grows, eventually hits the sound speed and goes through a critical point out here at typically a few hundred stellar radii. The phi velocity initially is Keplerian, and as we start to get to the critical point, the gas goes over into angular momentum conservation, and then the phi velocity starts dropping as 1 on r. Now, take all of that, put it into a all-singing, all-dancing radiative transfer code, as my Scottish friend likes to call these things. Solves the non-LTE level populations of hydrogen, does the radiative equilibrium temperature for the free electrons, so on and so forth, does a bunch of Monte Carlo photons, and eventually out pops a spectrum or an image like we saw. Take this, apply it to zeta tau. Essentially, these models have two primary parameters, the density of the disk, which is proportional to the mass loss divided by that alpha parameter. So if we don't know alpha, we don't know m naught, we just know the surface density, and the inclination angle. And lo and behold, everything fits actually pretty well. So the red line here is the observed SED, black line is the model, gray line up here is actually the bare photosphere. Notice that you're looking at this thing edge on, and so actually the disk in front of the star, because it's cooler and absorbing, the flux that you actually observe is lower there. Out in the infrared, goes the other way. Here's the star down here, and then the disk is adding extra light. I told you it was competition between two different effects. Out in the infrared, the size increase of the effective photosphere wins. Okay, polarization. We reproduce the Balmer jump and the Balmer continuum and the Balmer level, which means we got the inclination angle right. We've also got the n equals 2 and n equals 3 level populations right. Those weren't free parameters. Those are just calculated out of the radiative excitations. Okay, zeta tau has a spiral density wave in the disk. That is seen in interferometry and the differential phase across the line. Notice that this is asymmetric, which means that there's more material on one side of the star than the other. And that takes a density wave in the disk. All of those along different baselines match amazingly well. If you spin the star around, you're looking at the effect of the disk precessing, and you can measure the V on R variations, the predicted V on R variations of the black line. Circles here are what are observed. We actually fit the V on R variations. Not only that, if we look at the bracket gamma line, bracket gamma is formed closer to the star. In a spiral density wave, that means it's twisted a little bit, and there's a phase lag between bracket gamma and H alpha, and we match the phase lag as well. Shake your head. Yes, it's amazing. Furthermore, there's a slight perceived variation of the position angle of the disk in the interferometry as this thing processes around, and we match that too. Okay, so hopefully I've convinced you that maybe there's something to this.
What sets the period of the precession? Do you actually put that in by first principles, or is that just artificially put in by hand?
Well, you can get a long story from Matsuo about this.
Okay, but is it calculated from some kind of quantum mode model, or is it the one? Okay, very good.
Yeah.
Great.
But okay, now time-dependent stuff. So as I'm heading towards running out of time, got what 10 minutes here, roughly? Okay, so BE disks aren't just stable structures. They come and go over periods of decades. This disk completely disappears and comes back in some cases. Here's an example of Pi Aquarii where the polarization is slowly dropping off to close to zero, meaning the disk is disappearing. But along the way, there are some bumps and hiccups here. So something is adding, for a little bit of time, adding more mass back into the disk once in a while. Now that we have a good physical model of the disk, we can go on and try to predict what you would observe in a time-dependent scenario. So simplest thing to do, turn on the mass loss rate with nothing there, let the disk build, see how things change. Then after the disk is built, turn off the source of mass, let it drain back down. So here is the density starting from basically zero at half a year. We get up to the first curve. Eventually, after 50 years, we're starting to approach the quote steady state line here. Now we turn it off, and the viscous diffusion time scale increases with radius. So the material that moves the most initially is the stuff in the inner part of the disk, and it starts draining back onto the star, goes over into accretion. And so quickly, the inner part of the disk drops by one, two orders of magnitude in a relatively short period of time. Now, the inner part of the disk is flowing inward, the outer part's flowing outward, so there's a stagnation point in the disk. Outside that stagnation point, material is flowing away, inside is flowing inward. Notice that the density gradient here is steep, minus 3.5, that produces the accretion. We get a shallow density gradient inside there, that produces the accretion. What that means is when you are doing observations trying to measure the radial density slope, you might get different values depending upon the time detail, time-dependent state of the disk. Okay, I think I will skip this. I'll just briefly mention that Harmanitz in 83 found interesting correlations between growing disks, changes in the magnitude, and changes in the color. And the model basically reproduces almost, except for one little small detail, what goes on there. By looking in the MACHO database, you can find tons of examples of BE stars that undergo these little periodic outbursts. So here's an example of a star that's more pole on. It gets brighter when we were looking pole on during the outburst and then decays back down. It also gets brighter, changes color, and notice that this runs around a loop, not just a straight line up and down. If it were just the overall density of the disk going up and down, it would have one straight trajectory there. The fact that you get a loop means the structure of the density is changing. The density in the inner part of the disk has a different slope than in the outer part. And that's partly why you get loops like that. You can also look in polarization. This is the work that John Wisniewski and Zach Draper did. That outburst in Pi Aquarii, if you follow it in detail, you can measure lots of things about the polarization. One of them is the polarization Balmer jump. Okay, that's the size, the ratio actually, of the polarization on the high side of the jump to the low side of the jump. During that outburst, it goes up, gets brighter, so to speak, stronger polarization, and it runs around a loop, kind of like this, during an outburst. Again, not a simple straight line, but it runs around the loop. Okay, if we take our models now and calculate what the polarization should do here, we can predict the polarization Balmer jump, we can predict the polarization level. Here's some models that Xavier ran. Here's a sort of intermediate inclination angle, if you want to call 70 intermediate. As the disk is initially building, the polarization rises along with the Balmer jump, basically saturates up here. Then we turn off the mass loss rate, the inner part of the disk reaccretes faster, and the polarization comes back this way. Well, there's actually a good reason for this. The good reason for it is the disk, the time scale in the inner part of the disk is shorter than the outer part of the disk. So that means that what disappears first is the inner part of the disk. What creates that Balmer jump in the polarization is the boundary attenuation between the scatterer and the star. Well, what's between the scatterer and the star? That's the inner part of the disk. Remove the inner part of the disk, and guess what? Your Balmer jump goes away. Polarization doesn't go away because there's still plenty of scatterers around you. So what happens is the polarization drops quickly, and the Balmer jump drops quickly, and then eventually as the sort of intermediate parts of the disk start to drain away, then the polarization level falls. And so you get these loops. Furthermore, these loops are clockwise. So that tells us that the disks actually grow and dissipate inside out. Maybe this is the smoking gun that it actually comes from the star. Maybe not, but I wouldn't go quite that far. Sorry? Oh yeah, I'm going to blame it on Rivi. That's exactly where I'm going. I'm going to blame it on Rivi now, because Rivi noticed this in '81 by spectroscopic means. Not quite, but darn close. Let's see, 81, I must have gotten the date wrong on that.
I think it's 2001.
Yeah, well, my memory's not so good anymore.
I just guess somewhere in the 2000s where I signed it pretty big.
I know. You pick one day, it's bound to be close enough. Okay, another case, disappearing disk. Omega CMA, it has these outbursts. Was running along roughly steady in V and all of a sudden disappears. V band is, because it's relatively small optical depth, is very close to the star, and so that's very sensitive to changes in the inner part of the disk. So basically, we turned on the mass loss for a while, built up a steady disk, turned it off, watched it decay. To match the detailed shape of the decay, it depends upon the value of the viscosity, and so we could actually measure that alpha here was 1. Now let me point out something else here. Now that we know alpha, we know the mass loss rate. Before we only know the ratio, but now we actually know the mass loss rate. And that is a whopping big number. 3 × 10⁻⁸ solar masses a year. Stellar winds, from UV lines, m.q's are 10⁻¹0, maybe 10⁻⁹. Yes.
Is that m dot that gets lost from the system, or m dot as it is ejected from the star?
We'll talk in detail here. This is m dot lost in the disk, not as ejected by the star. I don't want to get into the detail of the difference between the two. Let's just suffice it to say that some of the stuff wants to recirculate, so you got to be careful how much goes out versus back in. Okay, some of these stars have quasi-periodic outbursts, just one after another, boom, boom, boom. So what happens when we try to model something like that? So a very simple model, just do a square wave, turn on the mass loss rate, shut it off, turn it on, shut it off once a year. Now what happens is the steady state portion of the disk drops by about a factor of 3. This is what Rivi's alluding to. Part of that mass loss gets re-accreted back onto the star, but some of it still gets carried on out. Now in the inner part, really rather interesting, the inside part of it, the density, flops up and down. And you have basically whatever slope you want there, depending upon when you look. Okay, now we can model light curves. One thing I'll point out here is the rise time. We instantaneously turned on the mass loss rate. Now the disk starts building. The infrared excesses start rising. A K-band here, it rises up very quickly. Saturates, then we turn it off and it decays back down. Now it looks like the times are different, right? They are different, but it's the same value of alpha. Turns out the rise time is faster than the decay time for a given value of alpha. So the disks always grow faster than they decay, and that's sort of what's responsible for these slight asymmetries in these shapes. Okay, omega CMA, I'm almost done. Had several outbursts. Here is the historic light curve. And now you can say, well, if we have some confidence that these time-dependent models are actually working, maybe they mean something. We can actually now try to measure the mass loss rate as a function of time and see what went into all of these individual outbursts. So this is a new student that Alex has in his group, his massive group of students here. Mohammed Barishi, who I just met almost this morning, did these models for us. And here's the detailed light curve. The blue line here is, quote, his fit to the light curve. And to get the fit, he modulated the mass loss rate up and down. Now, what's most interesting here about all of this is that the rate at which the mass loss has to go up and down is that it's almost an instantaneous change in the mass loss rate. It's not just slowly ramping up or ramping down. It's like it's switching on and off. Which kind of seems, well, crazy, but then again. So this almost makes me want to say there's some kind of trigger. Okay, so conclusions here. From our modeling of the disk loss, we find that alpha is 1. The mass loss rate is much bigger than the stellar wind, which immediately implies that any model that wants to make the disk from a stellar wind can't get enough mass into that disk. So stellar winds, really, I mean, it's going to be probably almost impossible now to produce these kinds of mass loss rates with a stellar wind. So the mass has to come from some other place on the star. If the mass loss rate were this big in a stellar wind, you'd easily see it absorbing in front of the stellar photosphere. So that tells you that this mass has to be flowing off of a teeny tiny solid angle on the stellar surface, probably the equator. Okay, disks grow from the inside out. Mass injection switches on and off, which leads to these questions. What really is the equatorial rotation rate of the stars? That's really one of the key unsolved puzzles here, I think. How ablate are the stars? That might help answer it. Is there differential rotation? We heard some hints of that. Maybe there is differential rotation between the pole and the equator. Maybe the equator is rotating a lot faster than the pole for some, or the mid-latitudes for some reason. Is there differential rotation between the interior and the atmosphere? That one seems more likely to me. Suppose the subsurface layers were rotating much faster than the atmosphere, and then something once in a while couples the outermost layer of the atmosphere to the layers just below it, spin them up, then your outburst. That's your outburst trigger. I don't know. What's the trigger? Pulsations, maybe. There's circumstantial evidence of this. But then there are stars with steady disks and one with these quasi-regular outbursts. So does the stellar interior supply the required angular momentum flux? Maybe it can't quite supply that angular momentum flux in some cases, which means it has to shift on and off, which means you have to store the angular momentum someplace for a while before tapping it. And when you tap it, you pull the angular momentum out, it spins down, shuts off. I don't know, crazy idea. Okay. Okay, let's see if I can make something up on the spur of the moment. So what Carol is alluding to is when you look at the polarization as a function of inclination angle, typically the maximum polarization occurs around 70 degrees, and when you go edge on, the polarization tends to be a bit lower. So I don't, because I didn't run these models, I don't know the details. It may be that at 70, we weren't really getting to the saturation of the polarization value, maybe the total density of mass. We weren't really up at the maximum polarization level yet.
Especially because I was thinking that it dissipates from the inside out. You would have thought that would have affected the V-band polarization more. I just wondered if there was something I was missing here. But.
Yeah, I don't know. Yes.
Because many models are based on 1D diffusion type equation.
That's right.
There is uncertainty there.
That's right. So what are the effects? Tsuo, for those of you who probably couldn't hear him, he's saying we have to be careful when we're applying models like this. There are a lot of model approximations, for example, simple 1D diffusion here. And 2D effects can be important and can change things. So that, of course, is always a caveat in this kind of thing. And I mean, you guys have done some work on what happens when you start allowing sort of extra dimensions in the diffusion. It changes the eigenmodes, for example, and the VNR variations. So when you're making quantitative calculations like that, modulo, always modulo those sorts of uncertainties.
So when you have these stars which you have beautiful matching of the data quantitatively, this is remarkable how well it works. But that star is seen pretty much edge on. That was later.
Zeta Tau, sorry. That's the one we've done the most detailed modeling of.
But that's a near edge on.
Yes.
Right? So what about the, not just the shelf features, but what about the ultraviolet wind features? What does that look like in that star? And is it possible that the wind that you're inferring from that star is enough to contribute to the mass bunching of the disk or the mass loss?
So Stan's asking me about the ultraviolet part of the spectrum, which we have not done any tests of because it's a hydrogen model.
Right.
So that's the part of the reason we haven't done that yet.
But just qualitatively, what do the UV, I mean, presumably the IUV observe that?
Oh yeah, so observationally, if you look at things like the carbon 4, silicon 4 lines, I think M.Q on zeta tau in those lines is something like a few 10 to the minus 10, probably.
Wait, I mean, zeta tau is a shell star and has always been a shell star. I think it was never observed without disk. So the UV spectrum is, for this purpose, completely unusable because it's fully veiled with metal, iron, whatever.
There's that. Yeah, well, that the line blanking stuff in the disk is at a slightly longer wavelength than the ultraviolet. It tends to be more around 1900 down to 2600 or so. So actually, the line blanketing in the disk is not so bad around the carbon 4 line.
Well, the other thing you have to worry about is the ultraviolet, the formation of any ultraviolet, if they're veiling is always going to be a problem, right? But there's a filling factor there. So the M.Q that you're inferring, if you're only blocking a certain amount of reflection of the star, you could be underestimated. So I don't know, I think it's still interesting.
Yes.
Whether the mass budget in the equator is really just diffusion or that there's actually material coming out.
No. Let me throw one more complication into this discussion, which is that there's probably a disk wind. And it's known from stuff that Karen was doing many, many years ago, along with Carol Grady, that the UV lines, a lot of that absorption comes at for stars that are at low latitude. So the inference is a good portion of that, especially in later spectral types, is from material just above the disk.
Right, but it's flowing outward. It's got a blue shift, so
yeah, that's right.
Coming off of the disk.
It's coming off of the disk, right.
So that, but then the question is what is that mass budget? What does that do to the mass budget? All right,
yeah, no, and I think that is down by at least one to two orders of magnitude below this number.
All right.